This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California. The views and opinions expressed today are not necessarily those of this station, the management, or the UC Board of Regents. Today we're here at In the Garden with University of California Master Gardeners of Orange County. Hi, I'm Mark Ortell, and I have with me today two very special guests. I have Chef Andrew Sutton, the culinary director of the Signature Restaurants at the Disneyland Resort, and Karen Beverland, the vice president of local and specialty sales at Fresh Point. We're really lucky to have both of these special guests here today because we're going to talk about this collaboration between the growers and small farmers here in Southern California that Karen works with at the Santa Monica and of course, other farmers markets here in Southern California, and how those products, that produce, finds its way onto our tables and into our kitchens, and especially for Chef Sutton's kitchen, and kitchens, I should say. The signature, I don't know if our audience is aware, but the signature restaurants at Disneyland includes, of course, the Keynote, which is the Napa Rose, which Chef Sutton started in, I believe, 2000 when he came over from Auberge du Soleil in Napa. And then also from there, he went to the, I believe it's the Carthay Circle Restaurant and Lounge was his next restaurant opened at Disneyland. And then, of course, the historic Club 33. And then 21 Royale and the Signature Bake Shop at Disney's Grand California Hotel. So there's a lot going on under Chef Sutton's apron and hat there with the Signature Restaurants. And Karen has been on our show before, known as the Produce Hunter. And Karen's been on, gosh, I saw a clip of her on Good Morning America, NPR radios with KCRW, the New York Times. I believe you're also writing a book, or have you written a book or a couple books, Sharon or Karen?
I am writing a book. The manuscript deadline is December 20th, and it's going to be a book about how to buy at the farmer's market and what my favorite varieties to look for. And it's very exciting.
Well, before we get into what's hot at the farmer's market, how does this collaboration work between you and chefs like Chef Sutton?
You know, I think there is a real affinity between chefs and farmers because they both are incredibly passionate about what they do. Both ways is not an easy way to make a living or have a career. It's a lot of work. It's stressful. It's relatively high pressure from different angles. And I honestly don't know two groups of people who, you know, work harder at what they do than chefs and farmers. A lot of the chefs aren't able to have a lot of contact with the farmers due to either geographical or scheduling issues. And so we view Fresh Point and me and our team at the farmers market specifically as a liaison between the farmer and the chef. And it's our job every week to find items that we think chefs will find amazing, and then find the most effective way to let them know about it. And with Chef Sutton's team, we spend a lot of time in a tech group, you know, as we're at the farmer's market, taking pictures of things and saying, hey, there's this. We go there once a month and do a presentation to all of their chefs and cooks, bartenders, lately we're even some finance people, and do a presentation on, you know, what will be around for a while, and, you know, what they should think about starting to put on the menu. So in those cases, we're kind of being the muse, where the farmers market is really super inspirational for chefs. We're trying to bring that to them in a way that makes them, you know, almost feel like they're there. Try to give them the information that the farmer's given us. Let them try the product. A lot of times, Chef Sutton, you know, as I'm talking, he'll be cutting up something and then just like dress it with olive oil and some lemon and some salt and pepper, and then has everybody try it.
I think we discussed at one point he'd done that with something as simple as raw asparagus.
Exactly. Very simple. It's always just trying to present the product to his chef in a way that inspires them to riff on it from there.
I as I was researching and preparing for this show today, I loved a beautiful quote from Chef Sutton. It's, "I like a beautiful plate with great flavor. After all, the culinary arts are the only art forms that touch all the senses." And I was so impressed by that. And I sense that you are an artist too, Karen, and in that you're working with these farmers and the flavors and the aromas and not necessarily the prettiest vegetables, but the best tasting and maybe the aromatic things of that nature. Is that a fair assessment on my part?
I think I'm going to bow to Chef Sutton on the artistic part, but yes, it really is all about flavor. And yes, sometimes the most flavorful things are not the most beautiful, but if we bring something that tastes amazing to chefs, they'll figure out the best way to get it on the plate and have it be, you know, delicious. And so we just want to funnel those items to them. And a lot of times we'll find a new item that we haven't seen before, haven't tried before, and I'll take it home and cook with it myself. But then I send samples, you know, or hand out samples to chefs and say, hey, you know, let me know what you think. And a lot of that kind of communication goes into informing, you know, how we present those items to other chefs. You know, I'm not a chef. I don't think I have the talent that they have. And I don't have the same experience. So getting that kind of feedback from them is super interesting. You know, we were at the farmer's market one day, and there's this amazing book called Flavorama by Dr. Arielle Johnson. And she was at the farmer's market, and we were talking about how different aroma molecules, even how personal experience can inform how you perceive a flavor. And when we taste, or when I and Jillian Ferguson from KCRW, when we were talking about it, when we taste borage flowers, we taste cucumber. But when a chef that we work with, who works with oysters every day, and oysters and cucumbers have the same major aroma molecule. And when he tastes borage flower, he tastes oyster.
Interesting. Interesting.
So his experience, tweaks how he perceives that same aroma molecule.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Well, let me ask you, what's, now that we're coming into summer, what's hot at the farmer's market now?
Well, we're really excited about, you know, all the great tomatoes squash, eggplant. You know, we're in legitimate ratatouille stage right now.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a lot of great heirloom tomatoes. It seems that the heirlooms, the purple heirlooms, are ready first, like Black Brandywine, Chocolate Stripe, Purple Cherokee. They seem to come off first, and then the other colors and other varieties start later. So initially, we end up with a lot of purple heirloom tomatoes, and then we'll roll into other varieties as the season progresses.
Now, stone fruit, are we going into stone fruit season or middle of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the challenges with stone fruit is the early varieties tend to be cling, and chefs prefer freestone because they're easier to prep and make better slices. But what we discovered this year, there was a variety of white peach called Rich Snow. And when I looked up, it was patented by Zager Genetics. And when I looked up the plant patent, it says it was cling, but it also said on the plant patent that it bricked 14.5. So we were getting them from Regeer Family Farms, and they bricked closer to 19, and they were freestone.
What does bricks mean? Explain that for us.
Bricks is a sugar measurement, a way to measure sugar, and it is the amount of soluble sugar in a solution. So it is, we take a piece of peach and we squeeze it onto the lens of this, of the refractometer, and then it measures the sugar in that juice. So we can, this is something that wine grape growers use to decide when to harvest. There are minimums. The USDA dictates minimums for a lot of fruit, that they have to have a certain amount of sugar before they can be harvested. And so when we're at the farmer's market, we test all the fruit that we buy. And so, and we include those Brix numbers when we send out a report that says what we have on hand.
Okay.
So that chefs can kind of have an idea of how sweet. I mean, Brix is, sugar is not the be-all and end-all of flavor. Acid is an important part of that, too.
Okay.
But there's no way to easily, there's no instant acid test that we could do at the farmer's market. So then we just have to be able to say, you know, this is a high-acid peach or this is a low-acid peach. Because a lot of times, a peach that bricks 16 and low-acid will taste sweeter than a peach that bricks 20 and is high acid, because it's like the difference between a glass of sugar water and a glass of lemonade. That acid kind of cuts through some of the sugar, and so you're not just tasting pure sweetness.
Okay, now, speaking of sugar, sugar cube melon, what is, tell me about that.
Oh, one more thing. So when I contacted Zager Genetics,
That's okay.
That cling peach was when they were harvesting it at a, what they considered a ripe stage, it was cling. But when Troy Regeer was harvesting them truly tree ripe, you know, with a lot more, you know, almost 30% more bricks, more sugar, they became freestone. So, I mean, that's a really great thing to be able to tell our chefs, is that this farm harvests so ripe that it creates a more desirable peach because it is no, the pit is no longer hanging onto the flesh.
Let's jump on quickly. I wanted to ask you about a cabbage that you introduced me to, and I can't pronounce it. It's an Italian one. I'll let you do it. Verza Moretta di Veronella?
Yeah, that's perfect. It's Veronella. Verza Moretta di Veronella. This is a beautiful, if a gardener wants to go to the county fair and win the cabbage category, they should plant this variety.
And we can plant those now, right?
Yeah, I think now is the time. You're not too late. It's incredibly slow growing where most Savoy type cabbage. Most Savoy cabbage takes 80 to 100 days. This cabbage takes 150.
So almost twice the time.
Yes, it takes a real, and more than twice the time of like a cone cabbage, like any of the cone cabbage varieties like Caraflex.
Okay.
It's like three times that. So it's incredibly slow growing. And what we know about letting things grow and take their time is it increases the nutrient density. So at the end of 150 days, this is a cabbage with glorious wrapper leaves. And it's anywhere the sun has touched, it turns this beautiful deep purple. It's highly savoyed leaves, and it's absolutely gorgeous. When you pull the leaves out and if you blanch them, we had a lot of chefs who were blanching the leaves and then wrapping the leaves around some kind of filling, like I think we had a chef that was doing some kind of like a, almost like a pork pate, and then was filling it. And then we had other people that were filling it with things and then cooking it. And the beauty of the leaf, once it's been blanched and then laid around something, is stunning. It is such a glorious cabbage. And it's delicious, and it's incredibly nutrient-dense, and it's such a big deal in Italy, where it's from, that they have a sagra for every year, a big festival for this cabbage.
And I love it.
I love a culture that has festivals around their local special fruits and vegetables. You gotta love that.
Well, I know Chef Sutton in particular likes the density aspect, or nutritional density of this cabbage. And let me ask him a little bit about that.
A cabbage is more nutrient rich than other cabbages, or you know, a 90 day carrot versus a 180 day carrot, right? And in that, oddly enough, we are predisposed as human beings, in my opinion, to know that good nutrition tastes better. You know, it just makes you feel satiated. If you eat a bag of Doritos, you don't feel great. If you eat something like a crummy snack, but you have some real food, you feel better, right? So if you're constantly striving to not just snack but have something good or good for you, and then you elevate that, then it's even better for you. And I think that with that, like Karen was saying, driving for flavor will actually lead there, as long as you prepare your palate to taste for it. And it doesn't taste healthy. It doesn't taste dirty. It just, you know, my relationship would be wines and grapes.
Okay.
A grape that is well-developed has more character. And that's what we're talking about in this. We're looking at the character of the vegetable, and it's still a cabbage, which may be the most boring vegetable in the world to some. But if you used right, and then, you know, done in the right way, it's pretty exciting.
And it's the same concept as all the signature restaurants. They don't use spring mix anymore. They use either little gem lettuce, or they use this Salanova mix. So the Salanova lettuces are a relatively new group of lettuces, and they're baby-sized, right? The biggest one on the head is probably, 3.5, maybe 4 inches long. Salanova has three times as many leaves per head as any other lettuce variety. They have a ton of leaves in every head.
Very dense.
Very, yeah, but dense in a...
the foliage
in
part.
A poofy way.
Okay, got it.
And
full. Probably dense is probably the wrong word.
Yeah, very full. And so, but they're a fully grown lettuce, where spring mix is baby lettuce. And spring mix has lettuce leaves that, you know, if they get bent, they don't have the structure, and they don't have the same flavor, and they don't have the same ability on the plate to continue to look beautiful and kind of stand up and lift. And it's because they, the original spring mix, they were harvesting baby lettuces. But as we all are looking for nutrient-dense things, that's the move from a harvesting baby lettuce to a fully grown head of Salanova is a big difference. And it's more beautiful. It makes such a beautiful salad. And it's wonderful on many levels.
So let me take a break here. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And we're here today with Chef Andrew Sutton, Culinary Director of the Signature Restaurants at Disneyland Resort here in beautiful Anaheim, and Karen Beverlin, Vice President of Specialty Sales for FreshPoint and the Produce Hunter. I wanted to go back because I love artichokes, and I was in Rome last May, and an Italian lawyer took me to lunch, and we had an artichoke where instead of just eating the heart, we ate the entire artichoke. So I went to the local farmer's market because that's what master gardeners do, is we go search out this produce. And I found these beautiful little purple artichokes I have not been able to find anywhere in Southern California. Karen, who grows those at the farmer's market?
No one grows them right now at the farmer's market. We had one farmer that was growing Fisol, which was it's a small purple Italian artichoke, and that farmer went out of business. And then we had a mid-sized farmer who was also growing them, and they stopped growing them too. I think, as you're mentioning artichokes, like, don't get me started on artichokes. Chef Sutton's going, oh, please, dear God, don't let her talk about her artichoke penchant. I think one of the challenges is that here in the United States, artichokes originally came over from Italy in the 1800s. And they had big, thick hearts and a lot of meat on the leaves. And they were very creamy texture. But what we're experiencing is if they became really popular and plant breeders, farmers, growers wanted them to be available year round. And any time we take something delicious and try to tweak it, we're going to lose something, right? You will never find a seedless muscat grape that tastes as good as a original muscat grape, right? You will never find a carrot that's willing to grow in summer's heat that tastes as good as a Nantes carrot from the winter. It's seasonality. It's us. It's the humans trying to tweak seasonality. And so plant breeders created artichokes. First was a thornless variety. They called it thornless, that would hold up under heat. And they are very fibrous and don't have a lot of meat on the leaves. And they have a very shallow heart that when it breaks easily. It's like it kind of falls apart. And then they started growing artichokes from seed. And at the farmer's market, all those artichokes are grown from seed. So because the way that heirloom artichokes are produced is by tissue culture, plant propagation. So they're taking cuttings from the original plants, rooting them, planting them, and that's expensive. It's way more expensive. So where, artichoke growers used to have all heirloom, everything was from propagation. Now only like 10% is grown that way. All the rest is grown.
So bottom line, what artichoke should we have? What's the number one artichoke for California? What should I plant?
Oh, you have to find someone. I haven't ever searched for that, but you would have to find someone who has artichoke plants that were grown from propagation, from tissue culture, not seedlings.
But what species?
Globe. It's a globe.
It's a globe?
Globe
artichoke produced from propagation.
So when I divide my artichokes every year, that's what I'm doing. And I can do that at home.
Yeah, but it only works if it's an original globe that started that way. Like, you can do tissue culture on a globe from seed or a thornless, and you're never going to get back to the heirloom.
Because
you have to be working with the heirloom. You have to
so
be.
So globe's not going to give me the plant I want. Give me more.
What do you mean?
I want the original globe.
Yeah, that's it. Original globe grown from propagation.
You're going to have to. You're going to have to smuggle it in from.
I mean that's it. That's
Italy.
Why.
Right. Yeah.
You guys had them on the menu.
I know.
And
I loved them.
They're amazing. Well, they're like the artichokes from when I was a kid.
Yes.
And they are. They are. And there is that difference in flavor if you can find them and get them. I recently ate at an Italian restaurant, and I was thrilled. Italians, Romanesque, you know, the Rome Italian, you know, or artichokes. And I thought, oh, my gosh, is it really going to be, you know, where you can eat the whole stem and everything with that? And it came, and it was, but it just didn't taste the same as those artichokes. And I said, so I quizzed the chef, where did you get these artichokes? And I found out they came in a can. They were shipped over from Italy.
Oh, that's horrible.
They were put in a can.
Very disappointing.
And I thought, well, because it didn't taste the same as those fresh artichokes that we were eating.
Yeah, it can't possibly.
Never.
It can't possibly
never.
Taste the same.
It's never the same. Well, so now that we've beat this artichokes to death, probably more than people wanted to know about their home events. Let's also talk about, well, something that I'm passionate about now. I'm having a lot of fun with sweet potatoes. And I found that sweet potatoes grow exceptionally well in August in Southern California. When everything else in my garden is dying, the tomatoes can't survive that temperature at night over 70 degrees. We're all sweltering. We've got our air conditioners running at night. That's when my sweet potatoes, and I can grow multiple varieties. I have purple sweet potatoes, orange, white, multiple colors. Some are sweeter than others. And am I a trendsetter, or have I missed the boat? This has happened decades ago. And
this is when sweet potatoes are grown. This is the time. It's another one of those seasonal things. This is why shopping the farmer's market is so helpful, because it shows you when something is in season. The difference with sweet potatoes is they store, right? So they are grown during the summer, and it makes sense because, you know, they're big in the South, that they have to be able to handle heat. And so they're grown in the summer, they're harvested, and then stored. I mean, I think that it's just like squash. Winter squash isn't grown in the winter. It's grown in the summer, harvested in the late summer, early fall, and then stored. And storing winter squash increases the nutritional value and the sugar. And so there are some winter squash, like you would be planting now. Is it too late now to plant pumpkins, culinary pumpkins?
No. Pumpkins will grow all summer long. About 120 days, pumpkins are long growing. In fact, I just put pumpkins in the ground this morning before I came.
What variety did you put in the ground?
I put some French thing.
Muscat de Provence?
Yes.
Great pumpkin, right, Chef? Great.
Yes, love.
Great pumpkin. But
they call them the Cinderella pumpkins,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Muscat de Provence is a favorite, and the Italian version of that is Marina di Chioggia, which actually became our very most favorite pumpkin. The challenge with them is they have very thick walls, so they must store a long time before they're ready. Like any seed catalog will tell you, butternut squash must store for 2 months before you can eat it. 2 months from harvest. So harvest, cure in the field, then store. And we did a test a couple years ago with Marina di Chioggia. Thick wall, right? 2.5 inch thick wall.
Yes.
And after about 6 weeks, then we started cutting them and taking pictures. And at 6 weeks, you could see, you know, when you cut into a spaghetti squash, you can see the fibers.
Yes.
You can definitely see the fibers. When we first cut into the Marina di Chioggia, you could see the fibers. And then at 8 weeks, a quarter inch in from the outside, as they're continuing to store, that was smooth. And then you could see the fibers on the three, on everything towards the seed cavity. And then 2 more weeks, it was a half inch. And 2 more weeks after that, another half inch. So we actually, in very slow time lapse, were able to document how the curing or how the storing affected the quality of the pumpkin. And what would have happened is if we had sold those to Chef Sutton before they were completely cured, he would have gone, this is a fine pumpkin. It's fine. It tastes pretty good. It's a little watery, but, you know, okay. But because he's had them at their, the way they're supposed to be, when the texture is beautiful and a little bit almost fluffy, and when the flavor is at its height and the sugar is at its height, that's huge. And so it becomes important when you're planting something like that. There are very few winter squash that can be eaten immediately. Delicata, eat it right away. Acorn squash, eat it right away. There's a cucurbit specialist, J. Brent Loy, from University of New Hampshire, and he did tons of research on winter squash. And he calls it the grower's paradox. And that is that the best squash have the highest dry matter and the lowest yield. The best winter squash. Highest dry matter, lowest yield. And dry matter is so important that Japan, when they import kabocha squash, they have a dry matter minimum for imported kabocha. They know how important dry matter is. So
all right, wait a minute. I got 2 questions.
Why first are they all, importing kabocha?
Wait a minute. No, first of all, how does one store this squash? Help us home gardeners who are growing these wonderful
in your garage. In your garage with good, yep.
Good ventilation.
Room temperature, good ventilation. The best place I've ever seen to store was at Windrose Farm. They had an empty barn, and they laid pallets down and then just put all the pumpkins out on the
pallet. Okay. So,
they
so
need circulation.
All right, all right.
They need circulation.
And what is dry matter?
Dry, so...
Other than my sense of humor.
Yeah. Dry matter is basically starch and sugar.
Okay.
Right? So, in order to store well, it has to have enough dry matter, because over time in storage, it's going to convert the dry matter to sugar.
Sure. Sure.
And then if it doesn't have enough dry matter, then it's going to fall apart. Right? So that's why delicata doesn't store very well, and acorn doesn't. But growers, big ag growers, plant a lot of acorn because they get a lot of pounds per acre, right? So that's why you see a lot of acorn squash at the grocery store, but you hardly ever see it at the farmer's market, because it's grown for yield, not for flavor.
Not for flavor.
Not for flavor.
Now the kabocha squash grows great here in Southern California. You can grow it in your yard, in your backyard. The vines sprawl all over. They'll go up into your trees.
Oh, wow.
Everywhere. And you'll have these squash. And I guess that was my concern. Maybe I didn't store them long enough because I was not pleased with the flavor.
Okay. So first of all, I have a kabocha recommendation.
Okay.
And that is Tetsu Kabuto squash. So Oregon State University did a lot of research on winter squash. They have a big cucurbit program there. And they did a lot of research. And this year we had a hiccup with our Marina di Chioggia and our Muscata Provence. They didn't get harvested in time to store long enough to be good when we needed them to be. So we had to, like, cast around. And so we brought in Tetsu Kabuto. And it looks like a kabocha, but it stands a little taller. Like, it's more of an upright
kabocha. I wish the home audience could see how Karen stood a little taller in her chair as she described this. She is one with this squash.
Tetsu Kabuto. So it's a cross. It was crossed in Japan in the 1950s, and Tetsu Kabuto means iron helmet.
Okay.
It is very dark green. It's a little bit shinier than a kabocha.
Same size?
A same size, but not squished down.
Okay.
Right? So same size, but...
more of an upright.
Yes. And it has gorgeous dark orange flesh. It's very sweet. It's incredibly delicious. And so we switched everybody over to Tetsu Kabuto this year. And then when the Marina and the Moscato Provence were ready, people were like, you know, I'm going to stick with the Tetsu Kabuto. We really love it. And so we're really excited about it. And it is naturally resistant to the two molds that usually affect hard squash or winter squash in storage. So when OSU did all this research, it was like checking all the boxes. Is it sweet? Yep. Does it taste great? Yep. Good yield? Yep. Stores better than any other squash.
Okay, now you introduced me to a company that's grown Row 7 seeds.
And yes.
Was it the Kogi Nut?
Kogi Nut, we talked about, yep.
And I grew Kogi Nut, and I grew white acorn squash, which you introduced me to at the farmer's market. One of the farmers was growing.
Windrose had that.
White acorn squash, which, you know, doesn't grow as well, perhaps, as regular acorn squash, but the flavor is just incredible. And that it grows well here in Southern California. That's one of the things we have to look at oftentimes is the seeds and products that are being sold to us may come from the East Coast, different soil, an acidic soil, and don't do well here in California. But some of the local grown produce that we have here, it just does fabulous. And it's just the choosing the right variety for your backyard, for your soil, all of those things. And, of course, our climate. This year I noticed my apricots are about 2 weeks behind schedule that they normally are. My figs, I have brown figs in my yard, and the squirrels have started munching them, so I know that they're starting to get close to the first crop is beginning to be edible soon. And so we have lots of things to look forward to. Row 7 seeds, they're still thriving?
I have 4 recommendations from Row 7. And although Row 7 is basically breeders from Cornell, from that area, breeders from... They send seed all over the country to have people trial it in different areas. So Wiser Family Farms gets a lot of Row 7 seed to trial. And the things that we were excited about this year is garlic, which is a cross between garlic and leeks.
Oh, wow.
Yep. We were really excited about it. And you can eat the whole thing. Right, so you use the tops kind of like spinach and the bottom. They had a big push on garlic, and that was really exciting. That's a 95 to 100 day crop. Very nutrient dish, chef.
Yes,
dense,
I like
chef.
It. I like it.
And then Badger Flame Grape. I always say flame grape, but like go together. Badger Flame Beets.
Beets.
Badger Flame Beets. So their goal was the plant breeders wanted to take that. You know how beets are kind of earthy and kind of dirty tasting. You talked about the cabbage wasn't, and that's kind of a part of beets. They took that out of Badger Flames. So Badger Flame Beets are at their best when they're raw.
Wow.
And they're just a little bit sweet and, well, actually quite sweet. And there's the just a hint of bitterness at the finish when they're raw, but they're really delicious and incredibly beautiful. Like really, really gorgeous. And so Badger Flames were great. I was going to bring them today, but they're almost finished, so I didn't want to frustrate you.
That's a tease.
It is a tease. So I'm going to throw something out. I mean, I got to give you guys a couple recipes just for fun, right?
Please do. Please
do. While we're in the summertime and it's cool and it's nice, zucchini, these Badger Flame beets and that sort of thing, season them, just shave them real thin on a mandolin, season them with some salt, and let them sit, and water will come out of the vegetable, right? Drain that off, a little squeeze of lemon, a touch of olive oil, and then whatever you want, and they make the best salad. So you really don't have to do much to make these vegetables taste great, and it's a different texture. You know, everybody thinks you have to salt or cook zucchini. You just don't. They make the best salads. And then your sweet potatoes, I'd recommend cutting them nice planks about the thickness of your finger, skin on, brown, however you want, and then grill them with some olive oil and salt. They are just tremendous. Nice slow wood-burning grill or something like that. The flavor is. And then some pomegranates, a little drizzle, some yogurt, you know, and you got yourself an incredible vegetable, you know, side dish. I just think You guys are talking all this.
Guy, this is a creator right here. This is incredible.
Last month, when I came to do my Disney signature restaurant dog and pony show, we talked about asparagus, and Chef Sutton took a knife and sliced some of the asparagus on the bias and salt and pepper and
lemon and olive oil. That's
and it. Then passed it out to everybody to try, and it was amazing. It's such a great way to taste the product, and I think that's what's really great about these items from small farmers is it really is about flavor. It's all about flavor. I don't want to miss this other Row 7 thing, and that is it hasn't been released yet. The seed hasn't been released yet, but it's going to be, so you should keep checking back, and that is spinach lettuce.
That sounds confusing.
Do you remember? Yeah, okay. Do you remember Totsoy when it came in the whole head?
Yeah.
Okay, and you can picture how it like was laid out leaves.
Yeah.
So like okay. They were like laid out in concentric circles. So a lettuce breeder was unhappy with the nutrient density of lettuce, and so he wanted to create a more nutrient dense lettuce.
I like that.
And then they came up with spinach lettuce. So they must have released some seed because Weiser's going to get some for a trial. But I checked their website today and it's not on there yet. But I think that looks great. It's that real dark green that Totsoy is,
oh.
Right? That super dark green. And then the leaves laid out in a flat head. So it's like a non-heading variety, like laid out in concentric circles, super dark green, and maybe cupped a little bit. Undercut just
that's
a little bit.
So, Chef, you just solved one of the greatest problems that Southern Californians have with growing zucchini squash. The joke is that your neighbors, you know, they turn off the lights and close the doors when they see you coming with the extra zucchini from your backyard.
For sure.
And so if we could have a way to use that other than...
But I have a solution for that.
Oh, please, please.
Eat the squash blossoms.
Yeah, eat the blossoms.
If you eat the female, the male blossoms aren't going to give you zucchini. It's the female blossoms that give you the zucchini. So if you eat the female blossoms, you are basically managing your plant with benefits.
Okay,
right?
So let's talk about two things. How do we tell the difference between a male and a female squash blossom?
The male blossom is a stem, a calyx, and petals. And then the inside. And the female has an ovary attached. So the female
has the squash attached.
That was a scientific
little baby squashes on the bottom.
There you go.
There you go.
See, but then take out the stamen.
Yes.
You gotta do that. Otherwise it's just
bitter.
Weird.
Yeah.
It's bitter. It's bitter.
And then you can fill them with anything. You can toss them in pasta. You can make soups out of them. Soup with zucchini blossoms.
So my concept of eating squash blossoms is, you know, the Southern cooking method. You dip it in a batter and fry it.
It's delicious.
Anything's good dipped in batter and fried, but that's not what we're doing.
I mean, every culture has got a way
soup.
To utilize them.
You put them in soup, quesadillas.
Sure.
They've been eating squash blossoms. The ancient Latin American cultures have been managing their zucchini plants or their squash plants for eons because squash blossoms were a huge part of their menu.
I have a neighbor that brings over zucchini, and I don't want to see them.
Yeah.
And they're really lovely people, quite frankly.
But you run from them. It's like, no, go.
You could have eaten that blossom and that blossom and that blossom and that blossom, and then you wouldn't have this problem.
Yeah,
well, see, I grow the Ronde de Nice squash, which is
one.
Much smaller and doesn't give me as... the giant 2-foot-long zucchinis
sure.
when I go out of town for a few
days. I do
days.
Pity pants, so the plant stays small. And
compact.
I just put the blossoms. We never eat the zucchini.
Well, that's fabulous. That's fabulous. We've solved one of the greatest problems
actually,
for Southern California home gardeners.
As I was thinking about this our talk today, I actually put in my notes, eat some of the female blossoms, i.e. crop management with benefits. It's like, I think... everybody could manage their zucchini if they did that.
Chef Sutton has got to run and be the culinary director here at Disneyland.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being and sharing.
Karen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I'll finish off with Karen here, and we'll be right over there to see you all soon.
That would be.
Thank you so much, Chef.
Thank you.
Well, we've lost Chef Sutton. He's got to actually go work while we're here having fun. And while I remember to do this, this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California. And we have here today as our guest Karen Beverland, Vice President of Specialty Sales for Fresh Point. We've just been talking with Chef Andrew Sutton here at Napa Rose Restaurant, and obviously this is not an endorsement of any of the restaurants or products or names mentioned in the show today. These are all part of our educational process of growing and eating in our Orange County garden, our backyard garden. Now, what do we expect to be coming in July? What are we going to see in July?
So we're most excited about really great tomatoes. There's a tomato breeder called Artisan, and they have created some really great, some of our favorite tomatoes. There's a blush tomato. Now our farmers are planting blush 2.0. They continue to improve it. That's kind of cherry tomato size, but it's elongated and has a beautiful point at the end. And when you eat them, the skin's a little thick, but they're flavor bombs. And what the information that we've gotten from our farmers is that to get the best cherry tomatoes, you must stress the plants a little bit.
Okay, how do they stress?
By not giving them as much water as you think they need. So these farmers, like if you're going to plant blush cherry tomatoes, blush 2.0, you're going to want them to have them be the best they can be. You're going to want them to, the plants not to be lush and verdant and green. You don't want the plants to look like here. You want them to look a little stressed.
Okay.
They still need a canopy of leaves to protect the
fruit.
But you want them to be a little yellow. You want them to be not look super happy. And one farmer told me you have to keep them on the knife's edge between living and dying. And then you get his blush tomatoes. Other farmers plant them, but nobody's tastes like his. And he says that's the key, is stressing the plant.
Well, and I think that's what we see. We, a lot of times, a lot of the advertisements or classes, presentations are how to grow more tomatoes and bigger tomatoes. But that's not really our focus. Our focus, at least that for chefs and people that want to eat these things at home, is the most flavorful.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting you would say that. I had had read an article about apparently a grower in Germany is supposed to have the best tasting tomatoes in the world. And, of course, they went out and did a documentary on him. And one of the first things that I discovered was this stressing concept that you talked about. He withholds water from the plants. And he says what that causes the plant to do is establish deeper roots to pull more nutrients and moisture from the soil. And that makes sense, that whatever's coming into the plant, that's what's going to result in the fruit ultimately that we eat from the plant. So this is fascinating. We're doing it here in California.
And in addition, if you give them too much water, you are diluting the sugars in the fruit, right? You are actually, the same amount of sugar is there, but you're pumping more water in, and now it's diluted. It's not as concentrated. The flavor isn't as concentrated. So it makes a big difference. And our farmer said that he actually went to the farm of the breeder and said our tomatoes taste way better than what he has planted. And it's the stressing. It's huge.
Well, so that plays right in with our drought-tolerant landscape here in California as well, saving our water and everything
else. I think the drawback is not everyone wants an unattractive tomato plant. So if you have a place where you can hide some plants, where they you don't see them from your patio, maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what you want to plant, is the Blush 2.0, because they're amazing. They also have a group of cherry tomatoes that are the bee. They have like Bumblebee and all these different bee names. And those are amazing too. This whole group of round cherry tomatoes that are awesome. We're also excited about eggplant. And one of our favorite eggplants is Camo, K-A-M-O, an heirloom variety from Japan. And the interesting thing about this, besides its sweet and creamy, beautiful texture, low seeds, a really delicious eggplant, is it's not shiny.
So is this one of those Japanese eggplants?
It is a Japanese variety.
Elongated?
No, it's round.
Round, okay.
It is a Japanese variety, an heirloom, but it's round.
Now, big round or small round? Because I've seen eggplant.
No, like softball size.
Softball, okay.
Yeah.
And use it to say, you know, am I going to be able to make my eggplant parmesan?
Yeah, it's a beautiful eggplant parmesan. And we have a lot of chefs who have Italian restaurants that use this because it's such a great eggplant. So that's really important, that it's has a beautiful texture, not a lot of seeds, very sweet, delicious.
An eggplant is something that you can plant in the month of June in your California garden. It'll thrive in July. It loves the heat,
yep.
Like basil and your tomatoes and these other Mediterranean plants that we think of, but this is one that comes from Japan. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So we've got some eggplant growing in our garden. We've got some tomatoes. We've got our basil going. We probably got our oregano.
We talked about the squash. Another great heirloom is tromboncino. It's a variety that has a small bulb at one end and then a very long neck, like a 1 foot to 18 inch long neck.
Vining squash?
Yes. And if you if it grows on the ground, the neck curls.
Okay.
But if you can trellis it, it is a vining squash, so you can trellis it and then it will hang straight. And because all the seeds are confined to the bottom, to the blossom end and the base, all that neck has no seed. No, not even a seed cavity. So the texture is beautiful.
And is this a summer squash or more of a winter squash with a thicker skull?
It can be a winter squash, but we prefer it as a summer squash.
And so you can eat it right off the vine.
Absolutely, yeah. As an immature, we prefer it to like a zucchini.
I think that one of the things that's come out today is the eating the squash blossoms, which we have just saved myriads of gardeners in Southern California from the bane of their neighbors by
But Chef Sutton, the point that he made about removing the stamen out of the center is super important.
Because that is bitter.
But, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And that is an international food. I know that. I have a neighbor from India, and she comes and begs for my squash blossoms. And I look at her sideways like, no, if I give you my squash blossoms, I don't get my squash.
It is true that if you're getting misshapen squash or you're getting misshapen cucumbers, that's usually because you didn't have good pollination. That's what creates misshapen fruit, is poor pollination. So if you are seeing that, then you can try doing some hand pollination to encourage to get like a really nicely shaped. I brought some cucumbers today to show them, and there are a few that are misshapen, and that's what I'm going to talk about. This is only a sign of not great pollination.
Does it impact on the flavor?
No, it doesn't impact the flavor at all, and it doesn't impact the nutrient. It's just a physical appearance.
I think that's one of the things that I know at the UC Research Station, there was a few years back, they were researching strawberries. And, you know, the requirement for a strawberry to come to market was it needed to last for 2 weeks and look good. It had nothing to do with flavor. And that was what the UC Research Station was doing, is developing strawberries with great flavor that were big. That's
super important. I have a potato recommendation.
Oh, please, please.
There's a plant breeder in Alaska that breeds potatoes, and our favorite fingerling now is the Myrna. I think we call it Alaska Myrna. Some people call it Magic Myrna. And it's super yellow flesh, very sweet, beautiful texture. It's a light red on the outside and has blushes of yellow at the eyes. And it's amazing. And I thought of it because Weiser Family Farm is planting their starts this week.
Oh, really? They're just planting them now?
Yes. They can't.
Now, where's Weiser Farm located?
Their main farm is in Tehachapi.
Okay, so they can plant those in hot weather like that?
The plants do great. The tubers don't do well. So they want to plant now so that the tubers are growing later in the summer. And they tried to harvest in summer, and it didn't work. They had too much loss. But they can plant now and then harvest in September, and then they'll be great.
Wow, that's fabulous. Because one of the things, I grow potatoes, and I'm harvesting my potatoes now, my purple potatoes, and which the grandkids love with things like that.
Yeah.
We're down to the end here, and let's wrap things up. We've had today with us Karen Beverlin, Vice President of Specialty Sales for Fresh Point, and Chef Andrew Sutton of Napa Rose is his claim to fame, but we know him as the specialty restaurants here at Disney World or Disneyland. I guess we're not in Florida. With that, thank you for joining us here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, in the garden by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County.